She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And week after week, we bring you wonderful guests that hopefully do get you to think, and we don't tell you what to think. It's creating an opportunity for people to just expand their mind and say to yourself, what do I really think about this? Thanks for joining us today. We greatly appreciate our sponsors, and a special thanks today to the sponsor of this show, Chapman Tucson. They really have been a supporter of the Mrs. Green mission and vision every day since day one. And I have to add this, they sell some of the cleanest burning, most fuel efficient cars on the market today, which is why they are a supporter of my mission and vision. So if you're in the market for a clean green car, please visit ChapmanTucson.com, check them out. And of course, I always like to do the plug, tell them Mrs. Green sent you. It's a great idea. We have another great show lined up today. This hour, I'll be interviewing Lorraine Lewandrowski, and we'll be talking about keeping it rural, keeping it real, all about the small farmer in America and the challenges they, and in turn, we face as a nation. So, Lorraine, thanks. We finally did it. I'm glad you're going to be a guest this hour.
Thanks, Gina.
Okay, and you're cozy in upstate New York. Really?
Well, we've got quite a bit of snow here, but I'm cozy in my office here. So.
I'm a Jersey girl, and I've been hearing from a lot of people. Some people haven't gone out of their houses in a week. I think that would be me.
Oh, yeah, we have several inches.
Well,
so,
that's not too bad.
It's
cold. I mean, I have a friend that moved to Chicago, and boy, is she telling me it's bitter, bitter cold. And she works, so she's got to go out and face it. But anyway, I want to give you a proper introduction in just a minute. But first, something that's really exciting for Mrs. Green's World, and actually very apropos of this topic. We launched our very first Kickstarter campaign called What Am I Eating and Why Should I Care? It all starts with your fork. We started it last week. It's really moving forward. It's an important venture for us, and we hope you'll check it out on my website at mrsgreensworld.com and decide to make a pledge. Be a part of this journey with us, everybody out there that's listening. It's all about healthy eating and why everything you eat has an impact on you, on your health, and the health of our planet. So that's my shameless plug, my very proud plug. So let's get on and give you a very appropriate welcome. Your name is Lorraine Lewandrowski. You're an attorney. I want to emphasize this a couple of times. You're a fourth-generation dairy farmer owner in upstate New York. You have written articles about commodity farmers. They've been published in national publications. And I think it's very safe to say that you are quite passionate about what's going on with the small farmers in our country today. And also, my plug is, you know a lot about what's going on. So let's start. Let's make it all about you.
Okay. So we've been farming for a century on one farm.
That gives a lot of credibility. I mean, it really does. And I think what I'd like you to do to start the show is give us your overview of the situation of the average farmer, and what have you seen as a fourth-generation dairy farmer in upstate New York, as someone who has a finger on the pulse. What's happening with the small farmer nationally?
Well, you know, in my lifetime, what I've seen, you know, I've personally watched, you know, as dairy farmers, I've actually been watching this since I was a little girl. when I was a kid, we had over 600,000 dairy farms in the United States. Today, we're down to like 50,000, and
smokes.
We continue to lose them. I just was looking at this. So 9 out of 10 are gone. It's pretty similar in the pork sector, you know, some of the other meat sectors as well. We've lost many of the ranchers. I saw statistics the other day that in terms of pork farming, it's been the same thing. I became aware of it when I was really a little girl. I had a great privilege to be the next-door neighbor of the farmers who were very active during the Depression years. They led milk strikes in rural New York. They tried to batter rural New York. In fact, they had made such a ruckus in rural New York about the farm situation that the mayor of New York City even came up to our area to meet them. And the Time magazine came to my neighbor's farm. So I was really little, and I remember listening to the farmers talking about, you know, the situation of rural America. So as I grew up, I watched what was happening, and whenever I could, I would try to stem the loss of the farm somehow. Whether it was, you know, a little kid, I remember giving a speech to the other little school children, saying that we should fight for rural America. You know, and then later I went to law school, and you know, now I try to talk to the public about what's happened in rural America. But I am heartened by one thing. I think that there's a growing an interest. Because I remember for many years there was really not that much interest in what was going on in rural America. You know, I would talk to people. I remember in the 1988, in the mid-80s, there were around the 1985 Farm Bill, there were huge rallies around the country. And if you go on YouTube or some of the, they call them farm justice type of pages, they talk about these things where the farms were being lost in big numbers. You know, I remember in the early 90s talking to politicians about losing the family farms and having so many of them tell me that it doesn't really matter, we're just going to import our food. You know, you should just get into something else. I remember as late as 1998 speaking to New York City officials who said that they actually told me that the family farms were dead and that big, efficient corporate farms from here on in would provide our food. So something's happened during the last several years. The pendulum is swinging
in the right direction.
People are taking an interest. Right. Yes, I think it's very much the right. At least urban people.
At least from where I sit, it's the right direction.
Yes, correct. The right direction. But that's why I think shows like yours are good, because you know, we get a chance to talk. You know, there hasn't been much. The family farms haven't been heard from a lot, you know, in terms of the media. You know, even despite a lot of writing going on, we're not seeing a lot of farmers in the media themselves actually talking. So I really encourage that among farmers, is to try to talk in whatever venue you can about what you see in rural America, because it's the only way that really urban people, and I call them the food thinkers, the food thinking people,
right,
are going to get information.
But let me ask you this. When you say they're disappearing, and I will go to the pendulum swinging backward, forward, which is very encouraging to me, are they being gobbled up so they're still operating as dairy farms? Are people building condos on them? Are they just laying empty? What caused the diminishing number?
Yeah. The different regions of the country have different dynamics.
Right.
And for example, in I was just looking at the statistics in Vermont, but I can tell you in New York specifically, in my lifetime, we've lost half of our agricultural land, and it would depend on the area. Like when you're near the Hudson River Valley or downstate,
right,
that land is being gobbled up for subdivision very quickly. I saw American Farmland Trust had a stat. It was like one farm being lost every 3 days.
Jeez.
in New York State. And I suspect the same in some of the states in the West, and areas where they have growing sprawl, we call it. In rural New York, when you get out into deep rural New York, so many of these farms that have gone out of business are simply sitting there pretty much empty. There's a report out by Cornell detailing we have 3 million acres of abandoned farms at this point in New York. So, you know, the Adirondack Park itself is 6 million acres. I don't know if you're familiar with the huge park that we have, but, you know, we have a massive amounts of land that are sitting grassland, primarily rain-fed grassland, sitting empty, that could be used, you know, maybe to come into production for milk or Cornell recommended local meat type of thing. But that's where I don't think many people in the cities know about the dynamics of when you get out into regions. So, and it varies in other parts of the country as well. The farm group that's in the biggest crunch are what we call the farmers of the middle.
Right.
We're seeing the smaller farmers where somebody's maybe farming on a very small level, farming part-time, maybe it's a hobby farm or, a retirement. We have some retirement farms here where the people have had a great career and then settle down to grow something.
And it's not their livelihood.
No, it's not their livelihood. Right. You know, I mean, I've got, there's a really great little cheese plant where they're making cheese, but the people are retired educators. You know, and I get my asparagus from a guy who's a retired engineer. But the farmer of the middle, I don't know if you're familiar with Fred Kirschenmann. He's the president of Stone Barns Center in Westchester County, just near New York City.
No, but I'm writing it down.
Yeah, Fred would be a wonderful interview. He's also the director of the Aldo Leopold Center at the University of Iowa on sustainable agriculture.
Okay.
So Fred has kind of coined this term called, or he promotes it quite a bit, farmer of the middle. So these are the farmers who are maybe grossing somewhere between $100,000 to, you know, $250,000. You know, they're for real farmers who are earning their entire living from the farm. They're not a huge, you know, they're still at the scale where the family themselves or with maybe a few employees are doing most of the work. So that particular group is being hit the hardest, you know, as the farmers, the larger scale farmers, are still there, maybe holding steady or even getting larger.
Right.
And then we're seeing a proliferation of some of these smaller farms, which, you know, which are good things. The small farms can be incubators for larger farms, you know, moving into a midsize. But yeah, we're seeing the biggest loss has been the farmer of the middle.
So let me ask you this. You have talked to, I mean, we've had some other conversations. You sent me some really great things for me to think about in terms of preparing for the show. A lot of people have in their mind in agriculture, they're either the good guys or the bad guys. And that's a really broad stroke to me to paint. It's like to me, ever since I started being Mrs. Green, I live in a gray area on a lot. People ask me, what do you think of this? And I look at them and I say, like an attorney, which will crack you up, it's complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, and it really is. So what are the things about this broad stroke about the good farmers and the bad farmers? Why don't you elaborate on that a little bit? I think you make some really good points.
Well, I found, you know, with some of the people who are involved in starting to think about food that, you know, they don't, a lot of them are thinking like with one, like a single litmus test,
right,
where they'll
right.
talk to, you know, I spoke in New York City in March and many people in the audience came up to me and said, but are you certified organic? And then I would say, no, we're not. And they'd go, well, you know, we're not that interested then. Or they'd say, you know, do you use pesticides? I said, well, I personally don't, but all my neighbors do. And then they say, oh, we're not interested. So, you know, there are many, many aspects, you know, it's like, I've worked as an environmental attorney. When you study an environmental impact of anything, you look at many, many facets to it. You know, you take a look at, you know, what that particular project would do in terms of water, biodiversity, land use, you know, just many, many, this way I find this single dimension thing to be really off-putting, because I don't know of any other field where you just ask someone, well, what is your, you know, you write them off if they don't comply with what, you know, you think is the one good thing, because there are many positives and negatives to any type of business, you know, whatever it is.
And
so, go ahead, Gina.
As a fourth generation dairy farmer, I want you to be totally put it out there. There
mm-hmm.
are, it's a really expensive process to be a certified organic farm. Not all farms that are not certified organic are bad. So
mm-hmm.
speak to that issue a little bit. That's the heart of the matter.
You know, I can tell you in New York, when I speak with some of the urban people and they tell me, oh, we only will support organic farms. All right, well, we have 7.2 million acres of farmland in New York. Only 165,000 of that is certified organic. So how do you feel about the remaining 7 million acres then? I can say, you know, we have up to 7.2 million acres, we have a third
right.
of this land is devoted to woodlot, is devoted to perennial pasture, has many ecosystem services. So just because somebody isn't certified organic does not mean that they're providing many great things for the environment. So that, for me, as a dairy farmer, you know, we've looked into organic. Our primary thing is we are graziers. We are grazing cows as much as the seasons allow on 500 acres of land. Our land is grass-fed, grass. It's natural. You know, we're not spraying anything on it. We have chosen not to go certified organic for two reasons. The first is that if you give a cow a shot of antibiotics, even one time, if
right.
she is sick, you must then get rid of that cow. So we are milking about 60 cows. You know, every one of our cows has a name. You know, we know their mother's name, their grandmother's name. Some of them have nicknames. So, you know, I do not want to load a cow on the truck to sell a cow because she's been sick and been treated once. So I'm very opposed to that. I've seen on some of the organic farms in my area when they sell a cow, she's put in the slaughter ring and then slaughtered. So for me, that's just not what I want. But, you know, I take a severe punishment for that.
Right, right.
When people say, well, you should be certified organic. The other thing is, I read through the organic manual, and they suggest having an extra $50,000 set aside to get you over the hump to become certified. So I'm just, you know, I'm just not that much into it that I would like to give up being able to treat a sick cow if possible. And I'm not into setting aside $50,000. I would like to maybe do value added or something before I would do that. Like, you know, maybe make my own cheese or something, you know, a product. But, you know, this judgmentalism is really, it's really tough because it's hard if you've never been on a farm to judge the farmer. You know, it's like I would have a hard time judging nurses. How do I know? I don't know enough about the nursing profession to tell someone they're a lousy nurse, or to, you know, tell my teachers in school that this one is lousy or that. You know, it's I would have to consider many things before I would say that. But I hear that a lot with farmers, where you're immediately judged if you're not what the, you know, the particular food person thinks you should be. So if you think that, you know, if you talk about saying that you'd like to have family farmers in the country, I would say, you know, get to know the family farmer. And that means getting to know them beyond just the farmers market people, but going out into the deeper rural areas. And, you know, this is where publications, radio shows, you know, whatever could play a really instrumental role in getting to know the farmers who are beyond the perimeter of the cities who supply the bulk of the food in this country.
And there's so much that I see now in just in the past 6 years, not being a fourth generation dairy farmer, but having gone to lots of rural farms on upstate New York. And that's true from, you know, this Jersey girl. There's two things that come to mind, and we probably won't be able to cover both of them until after the break. But one is, when you get the questions from people, are you organic? And you say no, and you say, okay, next. Is that where the market's going for a lot of the rural farmers? Because I've had, you know, Organic Valley on the show, and farmers are either closing, according to, you know, I talked to Teresa Marquez, they're closing down or going to certified organic because that's where a lot of the consumer is going. So it's a consumer, you know, driven decision. So is that what?
Well, in fluid milk, I know the largest gains in sales of fluid milk per se have been in organic milk. I don't think it's made as much difference. Like for our area in New York, our biggest market is we have Chobani yogurt, Fayette yogurt, 26 other yogurt plants. They are not organic. They are, you know, what we call conventional milk. Our biggest market here is just for the regular farmer who is, you know, producing milk with their family. And in New York, we have a very family-oriented type of agriculture. Average farm size is 113 cows. As compared to your state, if you're, you know, in Arizona, New Mexico, the farms are much larger. For example, New Mexico, the average farm is, the last stat I saw was about 2,400 cows. So it's a completely different type of agriculture than what we have here.
And it takes a lot of land.
It takes a lot of land.
Out here in the Old West.
Yeah, we, you know, because our land is so much more productive.
Right, right.
So, yeah, so I am not really seeing a lot of farmers going to organic. In my area anyway, the numbers seem to be about the same. I've heard that in the state of Maine, they've had more farmers going to organic.
Okay.
But the number right now of acreage in New York was about 165,000 acres organic, total acres 7.2 million. So I'm just not seeing it. What I'm seeing are maybe some efforts by farmers, like for example, my farm ships to a little independent cooperative of farmers who are like us, who are maybe long-term farmers who are smaller scale. We're not, you know, milking several thousand cows.
Right.
The families are doing the work. We've kind of banded together and we have our own little cooperatives. So we're trying to maybe establish a label, you know, or a name, you know, trying to differentiate ourselves a little bit from the market. So that's one thing I've been seeing here in New York. Is in Western New York, we have Upstate Producers Cooperative that has started bottling their own milk. They have photos of the farmers on the label. To the east of us, we have Cabot Creamery. Cabot produces all sorts of beautiful cheddar cheeses. And
I'm familiar with that, even out here in the Old West.
Yeah,
I love that.
You know, they just did a great thing. They on November 8th, they had 84 of their dairy farmers boarded two plaid-colored buses. They drove into Manhattan. They set up shop.
We
got to
take a break.
Stores.
Hold that thought. Well, let's talk about that when we come back. Lorraine Lewandrowski, who's talking about keeping it rural, keeping it real with farming. Please stay here with me. I'm hanging on to her every word. Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I know if you're listening, you're getting a lot to think about today. Not painting things with just such a broad stroke. My guest today is Lorraine Lewandrowski. She is an attorney. She's an author. She's a fourth-generation dairy farmer in upstate New York and is about as passionate on this issue as I am about being Mrs. Green. And Lorraine, I don't say that very often. It's like your passion is so contagious, and that's a very high compliment from someone who's interviewed
a lot
of people.
Thank you. And I love hearing about environmental issues, you know, so that's another aspect of all of this too.
It is, but let's tell the cheese story about Cabot cheese taking
Cabot
two buses. It's a great story.
Extraordinary. They, 84 of these farmers took 2 days off from their busy schedule, boarded buses from Vermont, New York, and went right into the heart of New York City. Set up at stores, 74 retail stores. They dressed identically in red plaid jackets, and they gave out free cheese. They greeted customers. They did food demos. They held press conferences. And, you know, the public was so receptive. It didn't matter that they're not certified organic or whatever. The farmers told their story. They told about the lands that their families maintain, their care of the cattle, their commitment to keeping their rural Vermont, rural New York beautiful and farmsteads. And you know, I just really had all these great reports of members of the public posing for selfies with the farmers, having their kids pose.
I love it. You're so modern. Picture. I love selfies. Okay.
Yeah, you know, so all of it is really great. The farmers are really, you know, in rural America, so many people do volunteer efforts.
Right.
Before they left town, they did this thing. They called it 55 Random Acts of Cheddar. And they went to 55 police stations and fire departments you know, not-for-profits. And they left them cheese baskets. And so they did their random acts of cheddar on the way out of town. So, you know, so I thought that was a really great way for the public to get to actually interact with people. So it was the first time anything like that has happened. So I'm hoping that there'll be some more, you know, I'm thinking they've got some more plans coming up. You know, my next door neighbor is a Cabot farmer. So, you know, I get a lot of information from her, and I tweeted a lot of photos. Some women farmers from my area sent me cell phone pictures of themselves with people in Manhattan and Brooklyn. And then I tweeted them out to my followers. I've got about 11,000 followers on Twitter. So
I'm counting on that for you really tweeting about this show, kiddo.
You
are very active on Twitter, and we'll be doing the same thing.
Yeah, I love to tweet. So I did tweet. I'm going to have to tweet that I was on the show. So there, you know, the thing that the people were so interested in are the landscapes, the working landscapes of Vermont, of New York, you know, these millions of acres of farms are providing ecosystem services. The New York City watershed itself, a good deal of New York City's water is filtered through farmland. They don't have to build a filtration plant because of the way the farmers have committed to try to maintain really clean water supplies for the people. So these were things that I thought that the public seemed to be so interested in. You know, another thing I'm really interested in are the biodiversity on farmland.
Right.
You know, it takes massive amounts of farmland to maintain grassland bird species. You know, and if you look in Vermont, or if you look in Massachusetts, where they've lost so many of their farms, they're losing their grassland birds. You know, same thing in New York and some of the areas, the grassland birds, the upland sandpipers, even the meadowlarks, the bobolinks, they're really struggling because we're losing farms in so many of these
areas.
And the
butterflies and the bees. I mean,
the butterflies, you know, I read there's a plan, which I'd recommend, the North American Monarch Butterfly Conservation Plan. It was written a few years ago, and it talks maybe like 3 years ago. It's an international consortium of Mexico and the United States, and I think Canada. And they talk about the various flyways of the monarchs. So they have a few flyways, the ones who come through the Midwest. And then there are, you know, the overwintering grounds in Mexico. And then we also used to have, which I didn't know about this, but we had massive overwintering grounds in California, which have been all pretty much wiped out by coastal development. So there's just a handful of overwintering grounds there. So I'm definitely going to be on the lookout for monarchs. We've got a lot of butterfly habitat on our farm, the milkweed. So you probably don't have that so much in Arizona.
Not so much. But you know, what you talk about to me, what actually touches my heart so much, and you define it so well, is it's a fragile ecosystem. And with the disappearance of a farm or 6,000 farms comes the disruption and the ripple effect, because nature is a fragile ecosystem. So I think you do a really good job.
Yeah, I find that very interesting. In 1989, my family hired professional wildlife biologists to come to our farm and to try to tell us what we might have in the way of threatened or endangered species and tell us about habitat.
Wow.
You know, we didn't, so it was 1989. It's been quite a time now. So we wanted to, at that point, kind of establish what we had. And it really, you know, the professional wildlife biologists were so thrilled to be paid by somebody to come out and go. We turned them loose for 3 days just to go reef through the land to look for anything. So they came back and they told us that we had northern harrier hawks and upland sandpipers that were getting increasingly rare. So since then, we've known how to take care of them. So that's another thing I really advocate for farmers to know what you have on your land, and, you know, get some, even if it's maybe students or whatever, to come out. And
it's,
you know,
all part of the know your farmer. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect segue, because one of the things I wanted to talk about, let's roll back to like last June, because it's a great story. And it's one of those timeless ones where your efforts to connect the deep rural farmers with the ever-growing food movement. Tell us about what happened last June in New York City. It's one of the ways that we connected. It's a great story.
Yeah, so a group of us went down to speak in New York City. Just Food had a conference, and so we submitted a couple of presentations, proposals to them, and you know, we submitted maybe history of the farmer justice movement. I submitted one on farms and ecosystems, and then we submitted one called just Introduction to the New York City, or to the New York State Milk Shed and Food Shed. So they selected that one. So we did go in, a bunch of us got in a car, we drove into Manhattan, we loaded up with cheese, artisan cheese from our neighbors, and we distributed. So, and we had a great time talking with people, but, you know, we were a little bit discouraged, though, because so many people said they were only interested in organic.
Right.
You know, and it was so hard to, you know, get over that hurdle. So that's what, too, I started tweeting to you, because, you know, you had commented about organic, but I guess there's just so much more.
She called me out on Twitter, everybody. It's so cool. It's so funny. And I was so concerned. I cared. And I read what's going out there. So I called you. I mean, it was a great way to have a conversation.
And that was really impressive, Gina, because sometimes I'll say to people, there's more than just one kind of farm, you know, 1% of the land. You've got the other 99%, you know, what's going on with them. And people will get so rigid. But I think what the Cabot farmers really got from the general public was, I think there's something, and especially in the younger people, there's like a drive to get too connected with the land again. And I don't know, you know, whether generations of city living couldn't kill that in these young people. So, you know, why? And so I really value the young people who are trying to get information.
Right.
So, you know, that's one particular group that I like to speak to. And I find some of them are trying to get educated in these topics. So I think the young people are the greatest asset going forward. And that was really great in New York City when the cabot farmers were there and little children were asking to pose for pictures with farmers. So maybe it's cool to be a farmer.
It's such a connection, though. It makes it real. That visual of
so,
all
so
them
we
going
were thinking
there.
Of designing like a coloring book for, you know, or something for really small children, you know, just of the farms, of the ecosystems. I spoke to an artist about drawing photos of or drawing pictures of grassland birds. You know, we started a Facebook page called New York Grasslands Alliance because in the Northeast, our greatest asset, we have rain-fed grasslands. We do not require irrigation.
Right.
They are perennial. They come back year after year. And, you know, they can, as they did traditionally in the 18 and 1900s, feed people if push came to shove, you know. So that's another topic I'm really interested in. Is food security for global scale cities. How do you feed south of me? There are 8.5 million people. I know that there's only a 3-day supply of food in New York City. And I know that because last summer I was invited to attend Governor Cuomo's function called the New York Yogurt Summit.
Right.
And at the Yogurt Summit, I sat with some guys from Cornell and we were talking about food. And they told me that within a day after we had our terrible incident with 9/11 hitting, the public officials immediately contacted Cornell and other food security experts wanting to know how much food does Manhattan have if there are further problems.
Right.
You know, this was for real.
This is for real. Yep.
So what is our – we have to think in terms of – we have a responsibility to think of how we will feed global-scale cities. You know, and we have Los Angeles, Boston, Philadelphia, you know, you name the global scale cities, and, you know, and I've been some overseas. What are the infrastructures and the food and water systems that will take care of an urbanizing planet? So that's something to me that's most important, you know, and I remember 9/11 so vividly because I was here in New York, in upstate New York, and, you know, people were in upstate were lining up to say, you know, can we go to the city to help in some way?
Right.
So, you know, so to me, one reason I'm so passionate about this over time is that, you know, I love New York City. My family, when they came from Europe, landed in Brooklyn and lived there for a little while before they came out to the sticks. But, you know, New York is our Big Apple, and, you know, maybe other people feel the same way about it.
I'm right there with you, kiddo. I was there for 9 days, and to me, there's just only one New York City. And I start walking like John Travolta, for listeners that remember who that is, when he was doing his Saturday Night Fever. But, I mean, you just there's an energy there that I have never felt duplicated anywhere in the world. I haven't been everywhere.
I love Los Angeles. I visit my college roommate in L.A. occasionally. You know, but I think of those cities, and for me, I know that day in, day out, 365 days a year, milk, yogurt, cheese, cottage cheese, hard cheese, cabbage cheese, cheddar cheese, artisan cheese, you know, food is actually flowing every single day of the year from rural New York. So maybe we're not the fancy, you know, the artisan farmer, perhaps, you know, selling at a farmer's market in a, you know, upscale place, but we are the good old reliable people who are putting, you know, glass of milk in your kid's hand. You know, we're giving you your cottage cheese. We're, you know, so to me, I think that's is an important part of the analysis on how our global scale cities are maintained.
And,
you know, it's the same with the watershed. We have a milk shed. We have a watershed. We have a food shed with a diverse, you know, and the other cities also have the same thing, the local, you know, things that could maybe help feed them. We have increasing one thing the Cornell guys told me is that the food supply chains are growing longer and longer for New York City. They're getting their food more and more globally. So, you know,
which
I
is scary in and of itself.
And,
you know, what about, and I don't know if you want to speak to this issue or not. I never put anybody on the spot about it. Mm-hmm. I would be disingenuous if I didn't say on the air that I'm moving to a more plant-based diet. I'm not a vegan. I'm not a vegetarian. But the issue of food scarcity to me and food security crosses all those lines. I mean, how much food do you think Tucson grows for itself, or Phoenix, which is millions of people? And, you know, you talk about Los Angeles. I've had guests on from Hawaii, and I've said, we're a desert island because we're not getting the majority of our food supply from our local farmer, whether you want a fresh tomato or a burger. It's coming from great distances. So doesn't what you say apply to the rural farmer, period, in terms of whether it's corn or tomatoes or whatever? It's something we really have to look at, because you're not going to be able to get your carrots either.
So it's, as far like for myself, I think what I advocate is trying to take a look at the at your region,
right,
and what natural resources your region has. So my region is rich in grassland, rich in water. I think that we
Lucky you, right? I mean,
and we're
seriously
fortunate, you know. Very. I mean, the last time I was in LA, the neighbor was trying to do a little irrigation system of his little flower garden, and he told me that he could only run it once every 48 hours. So he couldn't even grow a marigold, you know. So, you know, so for us, we have this really fantastic resource. So I that's why one reason I wanted to speak with the New York City food people, so that they could actually see what their resources are locally. And the resource that we have is grass. And that grass is great for milk. It's great for meat. You know, this is the resource that we have, and this is what we can use efficiently. It's very difficult in many of the areas to actually grow vegetables, unless you're in some of the better, like the river bottom areas with type 1 and 2 soil. So, and I'm all for preserving that type of farmland. You know, we have a young couple who started a vegetable farm in our area in the very last piece of land that isn't subdivided in the valley. So I think, you know, they're getting some growth. Some people are, you know, a lot of people are supporting them, hoping that they'll grow more to feed us fresh vegetables locally. You know, we're seeing, another thing I like are the urban gardens, where they're teaching the kids how to actually grow things in the city. New England Farmers Union recently opened up to invite urban Aggies in. So, you know, we're trying to kind of unite the urban Aggies and bring them in. So, you know, so those are some things. So, yeah, so I think in the future, you know, we're going to have more analysis of, you know, what it takes to feed the planet, whether, you know, whether you're, you know, what it is you're eating. I think people are going to think about it more.
And I mean, I think they better. When I was in New York in September, I went to this thing called Food Tank, the food think tank, and it was every possible, you know, configuration of people and experts, and we had people talking about, you know, expiration dates that are false, and but it was all about Food Tank, the think tank. And New York City has so much going on in every area. Food waste is another one. I mean, they're really being, to me, they're becoming one of the outstanding leaders. And one of the reasons is because they are an island that has to figure a lot out when you have that many people producing waste and consuming and on and on. I mean, it's great because other cities, I think, are now watching New York City, which didn't typically get connected with any type of...
Yeah, they were slow initially in recycling.
Late to the party.
They've, you know, they've increased in that. And, you know, as far as composting food waste, there's some in some initial phase. I'd spoken with the dean of Morrisville Ag College, was really interested in composting of food waste and maybe using it on farms, things like that. So, you know, so those are all positive. So the only thing I would ask from urban efforts, when urban people are talking about all these issues, is that they actually include the farmers. I find it very frustrating how so many of these efforts will talk about agriculture should do this or should do that, but they don't invite the farmers to attend. I really got rankled about this.
That's really ironic. Yeah.
So it's 2009. There was a huge conference in New York City called Food and Climate Change. And that was the year of the milk price crash. So in rural New York, we had farmers committing suicide. And the same week that the New York State farmers were literally going to Washington, D.C. to beg for help, some kind of help, any help, New York City held a food and climate change conference. No farmers were invited.
It just blows
me away. I contacted
them.
You know, I called them up. I said, "Wait, you know, what are you people doing?"
What
they
are
were
you
like,
doing?
"Oh, it never even occurred to us."
Just like everybody think about that for a minute. It's like, okay, what thing do we all have in common is we eat. It's like, it's part of the cold Kickstarter campaign. Know your farmer and know what starts with your fork. Whatever it is you're putting on it, just be aware of it. just, yeah, okay, so go on.
Say, it's, you know, the Know Your Farmer thing, let's have it be more than rhetoric. You know, actually know your farmer and invite them to these kind of
and care what they think and listen to them because they have some experience.
Because, you know, they are stakeholders in terms of knowing, you know. So this is one of the objections I've had to some of the urban food-based groups is that they very rarely invite farmers. You know, when I spoke at Just Food, I kept trying to speak with some of the leadership of some of the New York City organizations, and they really weren't that interested. They said, oh, Mark Bittman's going to come, and we're going to have Mark Bittman talk. We're going to go listen to him. So I was like, okay, fine, but he's never set foot on a farm in rural New York, that, you know, a dairy farm anyway. So
he's not an expert on everything. We're going to have to take another short break. And when we come back, I'd like to pick up where we left off and also talk about the what I call the Pac-Man effect in terms of food production. Everybody, please stay here with me. Time is flying. We're having fun. Lorraine Lee Wondrowski, Keeping It Rural, Keeping It Real.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World, next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine. It's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines. It gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit chapmantucson.com.
Habitat for Humanity's Habit Store is changing the world. By selling new and used building and home improvement materials to the public, the Habit Store is diverting more than 250 tons from the landfill each year. To donate, call 520-889-7200. Stop by and shop today. The Habit Store is located at 935 West Grant Road. Proceeds from all the sales go to Habitat for Humanity Tucson. For more information, go to habitattucson.org or call 520-889-7200.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I'm so happy that our guest today, Lorraine Lee Wondrowski, is getting us to think about lots of things. We're talking about keeping it rural, keeping it real. Lorraine is an attorney. She's a fourth-generation dairy farmer owner in upstate New York, so she does keep it real. She has written articles on commodity farmers and that have been published in national publications. And I am so very jealous because she has 11,000 followers on Twitter. And hopefully she'll...
I just pulled you up on here, Mrs. Green's World.
Yes.
Nice Twitter. So we're going to tweet about you.
And tell me what your hashtag is, because my team will be asking about it as we get ready to put the word out for this once the show goes live, and also as we put it, the podcast on our website, where it will live for quite some time.
Oh, great. Yeah, mine is NY Farmer, just simple NY for New York Farmer.
And, you know, I did know that because we've tagged you. I love it. That's so great, though. New York NY Farmer. So we'll have that hashtag, believe me. Okay, let's talk about the food production. And it is, I mean, sometimes, Lorraine, honestly, yeah, I feel so old because people don't even know what Pac-Man is. It's, I know what Pac-Man is, gobbling up the small guys to becoming a huge conglomerate. So fewer companies are controlling our food production globally. What is your land? What is your, you know, how do you weigh in on that on a global scale? It's a concern. People should really be worried about it.
It's just incredible the level of concentration that's occurred. You know, concentration at each level, you know, we're seeing the larger farms providing more and more of the food supply.
Right.
Which, you know, I don't have anything against larger farms. Some of the farms are multiple families operating a farm. But I'm talking very large farms where you're milking, say, for in farming 30,000, 40,000 cows. You know, the largest dairy farm in the world is now in Vietnam. The China 30,000 cow farm in Vietnam. China is building mega farms.
That's terrifying to me. I'm just
Saudi Arabia
go right out there. Oh God.
Some of the largest farms in the world are found in Saudi Arabia, milking cows in deserts. Then I know this because several years ago, Saudi buyers came to rural New York looking for some fine New York cows to start their herds. So cows from all over rural New York and the Northeast flew out of the Newark International Livestock Airport to be the foundation herds in Saudi Arabia. So my cheese-making teacher has been to China many times and talked about these massive-scale farms. So when we talk about a farm here in New York, you know, with a few hundred cows, they are nothing compared to these large farms. But even more importantly, like in the processing sector, you know, it's something like 10 companies now control almost everything that we see in the stores. You know, huge percentage. The stores themselves, Walmart, 24% of retail sales now go through Walmart.
Unbelievable.
So we're at a juncture where when you support I try to support independent wherever I can. You know, I shop at a chain that's a chain here, you know, relative to the Northeast. When I buy food, like say I buy cheese, I try to buy from what I know is a co-op. I love to buy the Cabot Co-op stuff because I know they're, the money will get back to this group of 1,200 farmers. I try to buy independent if I can. You know, it's not always possible, but, I think sometimes if people diverted even a percentage of their food dollar to kind of more independent and smaller things, it would be a huge help in the farmers markets. The globalization is really incredible.
I'm just going to make you laugh for a minute, but then ask you a question. I was mm-hmm. in Whole Foods Market here in Tucson yesterday, mm-hmm. and the laugh part was I walked in and I was shopping for some specific things, and there's Fabio. So I was like, and I called my husband and I said, Fabio is at the Whole Foods Market on River Road in Tucson, Arizona. So that gave me a chuckle. He was promoting his protein powder, and it would have cracked you up to see women literally throwing themselves at him. I was like, am I having an out-of-body experience? Because I've only seen Fabio on the cover of some books that I've seen as I go about. So that's a total aside. But anyway, Whole Foods, what I really wanted to go and spend some time there because the truth is Mr. Green does most of the shopping and cooking. It's the way that our partnership has worked. But what I saw were literally dozens and dozens, and I'm familiar with the Whole Food purchasing, you know, their intention mm-hmm. is dozens of labels. This was purchased locally. This is a local farmer. This is a local. I mean, we have a really good friends that own Isabella's Ice Cream, and mm-hmm. Whole Foods has picked them up here and in Phoenix, and it's been unbelievable for their business. So
yeah.
Is there in the independent grocery store that you shop, do you feel hope about their efforts to source locally to the extent they can?
I think a little bit more.
Okay.
I see, you know, occasionally they have, we're not a big vegetable producing area, but in the summer they do have some local.
The best.
I know like some of the smaller dairy products, like say Siggy's is a yogurt that goes back to Iceland.
Right, right.
It's Skyr is what it's called, Skyr. Hannaford's is the chain I shop at. I think they're based out of Maine. They've picked them up, and Whole Foods actually was instrumental in getting Siggy started. I was talking to one of the Whole Foods top buyers, and he said that Siggy's was selling at a little farmer's market somewhere, maybe in the Catskills or something, and they
right.
noticed him and helped him get going. So those are, I think those are very worthwhile efforts. And when people shop even just to buy directly from a farmer, if they have a farm stand or if they have a farmer's market or maybe, you know, through your CSA or whatever, those are all things that are encouraging farmers to try. You know, I know a few of the dairy farmers are trying to sell dairy beef on the side from meat from the dairy steers. You know, they've had interest, people asking, you know, so that's a source of income to those farmers. And it's also good clean meat that you know where it came from. You could see the farm, you know that there's no filler in it, and it supports the local processor. So even having a diversity of, increasing number of processors is a great thing rather than one mega processor in your area, one huge facility. And I think it makes sense just for just food security to have more processors around too, as it used to be in the old days when I was a kid. So
to have more of anything in the area of what we eat is really a better thing for food security. What's happening here is amazing to me. And Tucson, in Pima County is about 1 million people, so we're not that big, but our food co-op is one of the most successful in the country. And they're actually giving money out of the co-op for organic farmers and this includes, organic grass-fed beef as well as many vegetables. But there's one farm here called Sleeping Frog Farm that just produces, non-meat. Mm-hmm. And they're giving them money to help expand their land and expand the number of staff because they cannot meet the demand for certified organic produce.
Mm-hmm.
I never would have seen that 5 years ago. I mean, the consumer is looking for more.
People can help because it's so expensive. Like, say, for example, if you wanted to start a cheese-making plant.
Right.
I took a course on cheese facility construction, and, you're looking at $150,000 investment. So it's out of the bounds, it's out of the reach of most farmers.
Right.
The average farmer of the middle, I mean, in fact, most farmers in the United States, and Ag Secretary Vilsack acknowledges, have another job off the farm even to make ends meet.
Yeah, I love that phrase, farmer of the middle. I mean,
that's why I think Fred would make a great interview for you.
It's relatable.
Point.
And, I didn't catch his last name. I was writing, but Fred from the Leopold Center.
Yeah, Kirschenmann, Kirschenmann.
Okay.
At the Aldo Leopold Center.
Okay. I'll Google him.
Yeah, so Fred talking about farmer of the middle, I'd like to see more of that in the media. We don't see a lot of it. Maybe it's just not as glamorous as the person doing something new. I don't know. Even in terms of the coverage for the farm bill, the food movement spoke a lot about how they could encourage farmers markets and things like that, but they had very little to say on what it is that would keep the millions of acres of land in small dairy farms in New York or Vermont. So I kind of saw another, kind of disconnect there. But I think I would also advocate for diversity in terms of the food movement. We're not seeing a lot of that. It seems to be more urban people. I would like to say, I'd like to see suburban people, small town people, people of all races, income levels, talking more about food. It seems to be a little bit more of people who can afford to buy this type of food.
It's really a great point. Do you know the guy who's in New York, Steve Ritz, the Green Bronx Machine?
I've tweeted with him.
I mean, Lorraine, I'm telling you, he's the real deal. And I went and visited some of the farms, literally the places where he's growing vegetables, like under the Long Island Expressway. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Harlem, the Riverside Drive. I mean, this guy, and in schools, I mean, they're putting him on rooftops, they're doing aquaponics, and it's spreading. I mean, he's getting a lot of play, but you're right, not enough, not in the mainstream media.
I like to see that because, that's where I was so excited when New England Farmers Union opened their doors and said, hey, Urban Aggies, we want you to be our members.
Right,
right. That way, this is where they can connect. And I don't see enough going out into deep rural areas. Like, one area that's really neglected, the black farmers of America. Black farmers have been growing fruits and vegetables and been a little bit outside of the major commodity system.
Right.
Tuskegee Institute is having its 122nd farmer conference. 122 years of farmers conference. This will be February 20th at Tuskegee University, Alabama. Okay, so we don't hear much about that. These people have been doing this for 122 years. This is sustainable agriculture. So I'd like to see more reach out into deep rural areas to bring in people who have been working on food. And indeed, like my family, producing food for 100 years now. This should count for something.
Yeah, where does it come from? That's what people say. Where does this food that I get to eat every day come from? Know your farmer, know your source, on and on. And it's another good point you bring up about go to the experts and the farm bill. Did you read anything about that? There were a couple of small articles in the Wall Street Journal. I talked about it on my show with Annie Nelson, Willie mm-hmm. Nelson's wife. I interviewed her and a woman named Kelly King, who's doing great stuff with biodiesel. But it's like mm-hmm. the farm bill, And it's really big deal. I mean, Mrs. Green will keep trying.
When I was in grad school and I was taking courses in agribusiness and agriculture, my classmates were going, well, why would you want to do that? But now they're all saying, like, geez, we're a little worried because we can't get any, we're worried that something will happen. You know, going back to 9/11, my friends from the city were calling me going, can we come upstate to the farm?
Yes, like, can we live
like,
there?
Only what, if you help me milk cows. But right. They were like, we'll do anything. We need to feed our kids.
What's our plan B? I know. What about the use of social media? And I would like to talk a little bit about that. I mean, I'm one of the people that is trying to raise global consciousness, creating a global community of people who care about the planet. And one of the messages that I try to get out is use your power, like the farm bill, schmarm bill on one hand, because if you voted with your feet and your purse, we have all the power. People have the power. So what do you think the reason is that you have 11,000 followers on Twitter? What are you touching?
No, I don't. It's strange, but you know, people send. I had posted a lot of photos and just sunrise.
Right.
My sister's a vet. You know, when out on call, you know, saving some cow or doing, you know, and people would send me messages saying that they post the photos in their cubicle at work, that they don't have much contact with real, you know, people out in rural areas, and they really like it. There's a guy in Wales who's a shepherd. He's picked up like 12,000 followers, and Herdy Shepherd is his name. So I'm seeing there are certain people who are interested. So
it's touching something.
Positive.
Yeah, it's touching something.
And, you know, so people like that. And to me, it's been a way of establishing contact with people, too. That's how I ended up speaking in New York City, because one of my Twitter friends said, you know, you really should come to New York and speak. And I kind of doubted him. I said, nah, they wouldn't want me. And then, he urged me to. He kept tweeting, did you send your application in yet? You meet some really, I tweet to a couple of food writers. Like last night I tweeted an article, and then Michael Moss, who writes for the New York Times, retweeted it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, he's unreal. That's a big deal.
You know, That's a big deal. Occasionally Michael Pollan, if I see something that I would like tweeted, I contact him. I send him an email and say, could you tweet something about this? Like when the Chinese were purchasing Smithfield, they purchased one. They now own something like one out of five of every breeding sows in the United States of America,
or
the entire country.
Oh.
Okay, so I sent Mr. Pollan an email and said, you know, where is the food movement sitting around with artisan cheese hanging out of their mouths in silence? Nothing. They're saying nothing about this. So I said, please tweet an article about this. So about half an hour later, he starts tweeting about it. So I think, you know, you can use Twitter to contact some of these people to bring something to their attention, and maybe establish a dialogue. So that's a very valuable thing. And I know some of the bigger writers don't really interact with people on Twitter. They just kind of, I see that they consider what might be tweeted to them.
Right, and they don't follow hardly anybody.
No, they don't follow.
They have, 120,000 followers, and they follow...
They follow, but you know, my criticism of the food writers, they just follow each other. So I've sent them all nasty tweets saying,
that's
how come
a really
you guys
good
just follow
point.
Each other?
You're preaching to the choir. I mean, that's a really, really good point. It's like, let it out there. I love it when I get retweeted by Triple Pundit. I mean, we're just really trying to, get the word out there about all these shows and get people to think and decide what their opinion is and not be a robotic purchaser of food. I mean, it's to me very, very important.
I think it's so important. And, in our generation, but, I'm thinking more of the generation of my niece and her children, what sort of planet will they have? So that's why I think you really need the diversity and the inclusion. And I say the same thing to farmers. You're all just tweeting to each other. Why don't you, go and start talking to someone else?
Tag someone else, like Mrs. Greensworth. Look at all the stuff she has to say. But we have about a minute and a half left. What would you say the one call to action would be for people that are listening to the show, how to become involved or make a difference?
Well, I would say just, communicate. I like the Know Your Farmer phrase. I would like people to reach out. There's so fewer of us farmers left.
Right.
Okay, in New York, we're only 5,000 farms now, 5,000 dairy farms, as opposed to millions and millions of people. So if writers, communicators, they're the key people.
And even if they're not tagging us, we can tag them so that they know that we're making some noise out there. So
exactly.
I knew that this interview was going to be delightful and that the time was going to fly, and I never say anything on the air that I won't pinky swear to. So this has been
a great interview.
And you're not going to believe this, but next week we have one more generation. We're going to welcome Carter, age 13, and Olivia, age 11. I promise you'll be blown away by these two young people, their organization that they have founded, and the work they're doing to preserve wildlife all around the world. You want to join us. Lorraine, thank you so much. Everybody
Wonderful.
Out there, make it a great intentionally green week, and thanks for being with us. Know your farmer.
Thanks, Gina.
Thank you.